On last week's agenda, Laurie Hooper suggested he would pull his Tindall motion on releasing more detail about schools' assessments if the Education Minister conceded an improved position. The Minister tells us later what concessions she made, but first, was Mr. Hooper right in calling out government for requiring higher pay for migrant workers than Manx workers? Treasury Minister Alex Allanson doesn't think so, and he'll put his case shortly, but first a reminder of Mr. Hooper's thoughts.
So they've decided that we're not doing this for Manx workers because it's too difficult for businesses to pay, but we are going to do this for any foreigners coming here on a visa. That feels quite unfair to me. I think everyone should be paid a living wage, and I think you don't want to have a lower visa requirement than a minimum wage because you don't want to have people being undercut. But equally, what you don't want to do is tell people you can employ one person or another in this job, but if you employ a Manx person, it's going to be cheaper because you can pay them less. I don't think that's fair at all.
So, Treasury Minister Alex Allanson?
In Keys, a week or so ago now, you intervened in question time, basically, I guess, to try and support the Enterprise Minister, who was answering a question about the difference between the minimum wage that migrant workers would get and the minimum wage that Manx workers would get. And effectively, you said, we don't want migrant workers undercutting Manx workers in the jobs market. Basically, that means that Manx workers are going to get paid less than migrant workers. That can't be right, surely.
It isn't right, actually, and I think there's a misconception here. What we're talking about is the difference between a minimum annual salary, so what you earn over a year, and the minimum wage, which is what you earn in an hour. Now, in this country, we have a minimum wage, which is quite clearly set, and people can earn as much as they can in terms of how many hours they work. We've also got a minimum salary that people must be paid if they're going to move to this country on an immigration visa. And at the moment, it's remarkably low. It's about £20,000. And it's been so for quite some time. It hasn't gone up. In the UK, they've increased the minimum salary you must work as a skilled worker up to £38,000. So we're well out of kilter with the UK. So what we have proposed is to increase the minimum salary in stages, initially up to £25,000. That's if you want to come to this country, you've got to be earning £25,000 to support yourself because you're not eligible to benefits. That doesn't mean that they will be paid more of an hourly wage for doing the same job. That's against the equalities law. So I think people have got the wrong end of the stick in terms of some of these conversations. We're talking about the annual salary as opposed to the hourly wage that you'll get. And certainly I'm not advocating that people, immigrants, should be paid more than Manx workers. But what we need to do is make sure that we are attracting those people with the right skills to drive our economy and not attracting people who are doing jobs that people already on our island could be doing in the first place.
So, effectively then, your colleague for Ramsay has been making a bit of mischief on this question.
No, I don't think it's making mischief, but I think we need clarity in terms of immigration and where the Isle of Man stands on that. We need to grow the active working population. We need to meet the skills gaps that we have and sometimes the work gaps that we have. But we need to do that in a way that enhances our economy and our society. That's why we've got a large document coming in July, Tim Wild, from the Cabinet Office looking at overall immigration. That's why we've been talking a lot about an immigration health surcharge that people who arrive in the country on an immigration visa should be expected to pay towards the services that they get automatic access to by being here. We need to look at the salary that they're earning and making sure that they can support themselves and their dependents. And we need to look at the number of dependents who are coming over as well. This is part of an overall immigration policy. It's also coinciding with a further debate on the minimum wage, how we calculate it, and how we uphold the commitment in the Ireland plan to merge that with a living wage. And I think the two have got conflated, partly because government's doing an awful lot all at once, which resolves round some of the fundamentals of the Ireland plan, which was to increase median earnings, to look after the people on our island, to provide the infrastructure they need, to actively encourage people to join us, but to be absolutely certain that we've got border security, that our immigration routes aren't misused by anyone, and that the people we attract here have got the skills and the right attributes to benefit our society and actually afford a decent lifestyle while they're here.
So I'm trying to work this out. I mean, the point that Laurie Hooper was trying to make, I think, through his question in relation to this, was that effectively migrant workers will no longer be able to take some of the lowest paid jobs that are going to be available on the island. So he's kind of right in saying that effectively we're leaving the low-paid work to Manx workers. And I guess when you've got a situation which we have in the island with relatively full employment, very few people actually looking for work, we potentially, or you as a government, potentially run the risk of us not being able to fill some of those essential low-paid roles that we rely on in the Manx economy.
Not necessarily. The average minimum salary at £25,447 is based on a 37.5-hour week. Now, I know lots of people who work far longer than that, often on minimum wage, and earn more by actually having to work far more hours than they necessarily would like to, but they've got overheads, they've got bills to pay. We know that when you look at the breakdown of people who move over to our island on an immigration visa for a set period of time to work, often it is poorly paid skills such as chefs, such as people in hospitality, cleaners. They are often working quite long hours. They sign up to that, but they should be getting a decent wage for that. And as a country, we should be saying that the people who move over here to work should be earning enough to actually pay their way. And so I'm not saying that people should be deprived of working in the care sector, for instance, but they will need to be earning over £25,000 now as opposed to £20,000, because we know that the cost of living is more here than it is in the UK. We know we want to attract people, but we want to absolutely attract the people whose skills and attributes will contribute to our economy.
One of the ambitions stated by Isle of Man government in our island plan, and indeed by Tynwald, which backed the plan, is to introduce the living wage for all Manx workers. And I guess that will include migrant workers. By introducing the living wage, though, you then, if you do it in too big or too quick a step, you then have problems for those companies, people, employers that work in areas which tend to have lower paid workers. Other countries have provided some forms of assistance to help the people in those lower paid sectors, the firms particularly, to actually work through so that the minimum wage can be the same as the living wage. Isle of Man government seems to have kind of left this and basically said, no, we'll put the minimum wage up and it's really down to the employers to work it out. Am I being uncharitable by saying that?
Well, I think most people are being uncharitable to Treasury at the moment, so I won't hold that against you. I there are a couple of things there. So I think you're quite right. When Jersey said that they were moving to the living wage, they also presented a package of measures in their budget to try to ease that transition. We actually sat down and looked at that between Treasury, DfE and the Council of Ministers, and a lot of the things that they were proposing as new initiatives, we were already doing in terms of actively encouraging people to help with training, with recruitment, with retention of staff, with benefits to employers. So we already cover an awful lot of that. One of the other things that's gone on the Register of Business this week is a paper about how we meet the living wage, because this all stemmed from a poverty report going back to, I think, 2019. The world has changed dramatically since there in terms of how we quantify relative poverty, how various countries calculate what should be a living wage. Now, we use the calculation based on a Loughborough University basket of goods, founded by the Resolution Foundation. It's very complicated. The Living Wage Report that's coming out this week shows that this year the calculation is completely out of kilter and they've had to rebase it. So I think it's far better that we have a decent debate in Tynwald about actually what do we mean by the living wage? Do we mean it should be 66% of median earnings, which is the standard used in lots of different countries, rather than a statistical calculation which is based on lots of different household groups. I think if we can get clarity and support for that from Tynwald in July, Tynwald, when we debate the report, that would actually solve a lot of these problems from businesses and employees, that they don't know from one year to another what the wage increase will be, or if there will be any. I mean, the minimum wage didn't go up at all in 2020 or 2021 because of COVID. And now we're trying to pay catch up on that. So I think it's absolutely right that we go back to revisit what we actually mean by a living wage. Do we mean it's a statistical calculation which doesn't really fit to anyone? Or do we mean that it's a percentage of the median earnings which will increase as our economy increases and matches far more the ability for employers to pay those wages?
And of course, in the meantime, particularly the hospitality sector is struggling because people are going out less frequently to enjoy the hospitality that was provided by the sector, particularly going out for meals and drinks and the like. Is there a solution to this that government can be part of?
Government should create the right environment for other people to do well in terms of business, do well in terms of employment, earn wages, and spend in the local economy. So we've got a local economy strategy. We've got lots of things going on to try to enhance that, including clear government policies like on the minimum wage to actually drive increased earnings for people, increase their skills so they can earn more. Now, you've said the hospitality industry is in trouble. I agree in terms of pockets, that is true. But also there's been some real success stories around our island, particularly during TT. You saw people innovating, creating new products that were taken on board. Yes, there are some companies that have been struggling. There are some hotels that have struggled, some restaurants and bars. But we've also seen a huge amount of investment in those areas as well. And what government's role is to do is to actually try to support that inward investment, support those people to change their products. Because I think people's attitudes have changed about going out midweek. People's attitudes have changed about when they go out and how they spend their money. There is money being spent, but we need to make sure that that is evenly spread. And that's why the local economy strategy helps those businesses refine their offering and drive more footfall.
I guess at the start of this administration, you would have hoped that by now you would be seeing the more green shoots, and actually the green shoots actually developing into something that looks like a crop of some kind that can be harvested by your Treasury tax team. It's quite frustrating that whilst there may be some glimmers of hope, it's still glimmers as opposed to a full-on blast of sunshine.
I completely agree with you. And what we've been doing in terms of Treasury and DfE is looking at the local economy. We're actually not doing too badly. I mean, I know there's always doom and gloom. When you look at all the statistics that are published on the economic dashboard, we've got good employment, we've got good levels of investment in terms of people buying houses, and that's local people buying houses to live in. We've got healthy reserves. But I'd agree with you that it's in terms of some of the growth we saw during the perhaps 70s, 80s, 90s, that has waned now. We are doing okay, but we need to look forward in terms of what's the next thing we can help to do to boost our economy. And that's why we're spending time analysing that. That's why we're talking with people in business. That's why we've got an economic strategy and an island plan. But going forward, it's also why we need to liaise with the Isleman people to say, look, you know, we're doing okay at the moment, but to do better, we will need to actively encourage people to move over here. We've got the right skills to benefit our economy. We will need to see how we can incentivize increased connectivity, how we can get more people over here, how we can increase connectivity for people who live here, but also encourage businesses that are here to expand and encourage new businesses to join them.
You had a couple of questions to answer in Tynwald, one in relation to the Major Projects Board, the other in relation to Isle of Man government procurement policy. Is the Major Projects Board meeting sufficiently regularly to ensure that major projects are going to be delivered on budget, on time? And the reason, obviously, that many people want to know the answer to that question is because we've had similar boards, committees trying to steer major projects through. The Liverpool ferry terminal, of course, is the oft mentioned example of that. Are you convinced that enough is being done, enough meetings are being held, enough scrutiny is going into these things?
Yeah, I mean, both of these questions, when it comes down to it, were about value for money for the taxpayer. Major Projects Board was set up as an oversight board, getting some people from the private sector over to actually kick the tires of some of the proposals coming through, the big infrastructure projects, and saying, look, have you done the work to begin with to actually get a decent cost? Don't tell me it's going to cost 30 million when it ends up costing far more than that. Let's do the work to begin with. Let's look at the risks of delivery. And I think it has had some issues in terms of the number of big projects coming through. We're still developing what Castle Rushen may be costing for the new secondary school there. We're still looking at the major IT project for the Department of Health and Social Care in terms of unified record, so that patients and individuals can look at their own medical records and take those along when they see hospital consultants, wherever that is, whether that's here or across. So they are meeting regularly. However, I was quite honest today, there's no point meeting if you've got nothing on the agenda. There's no point doing a report if it's just a blank bit of paper. But that their ability to oversee some of these projects, to question and scrutinise some of the people driving those projects is absolutely right and will increase as some of these projects come online. In terms of Joni Farago's question about procurement, again, this is value for money. So yes, we should be spending more of the public purse on Ireland. We should be doing that to drive the local economy and to instill social value. We've brought forward ideas of what's called reserving, which is those tenders that are less than £100,000 will preferentially go for local companies, but we need to make sure that's good value for money. We need to make sure that they're investing in apprentices, everything else that we need. That's about £50 million annually that will be going into the local economy. That's over about £200 million each year that the government spend on buying goods, works and services through public procurement. But it's absolutely right that we should drive efficiencies in that and make sure that every pound that's spent is spent in the right way, which is why we've professionalised the service and why we will continue to review that to make sure that we get value for money, that we can spend money in the right areas and put it into those areas that really drive the economy going forward, but make sure that a lot of that goes to local companies as well, but that we get that value for money.
And of course the conflict that you have, certainly it was the case when I was in Council of Ministers, and I'm sure it's still the case, is on the one hand, yes, of course you want to support local business, you want to buy Manx food, for example, or use local contractors, Manx contractors for Isle of Man government jobs. But if you are too explicit about that in your policy, then the companies will say, oh, well, we know the government's got to use us, therefore we can add a whole whack of extra profit onto the contract.
You're absolutely right. You do tend to get less competition in small jurisdictions, particularly small Ireland. And we don't want to constantly go across, but sometimes for the big contracts, that makes far more sense. Or we talk to local companies and say, why don't you partner up with so-and-so in the UK or Ireland, and then with the economies of scale, we'll get much better value. And that's what the Department of Health and Social Care have done by teaming up in terms of the NHS procurement in the UK to get value for money. That's what the Department of Home Affairs have done in terms of procurement of some of the emergency service equipment that we won't be able to supply here. But by partnering with some of the big purchasers in the UK, they can, through economies of scale, scale, get better value for money for the Manx taxpayer. So, you know, in terms of procurement, yes, it is an art, and you need to be careful that you don't create effective monopolies on the Isle of Man. But it's also the case that you should be looking at trying to make sure that more money goes into the local economy because of the local multiplier effect and the way that can go around to increase the benefits and increase the financial sustainability of our island.
That was Treasury Minister Alex Allenson. Next, a reminder of Mr. Hooper's educational concerns.
So what I'm hoping, actually, is that I know there's going to be a briefing again this week now from the department. I'm hoping the minister will have managed to talk to her colleagues and will come out with a solution that says actually we are going to improve the way we deliver information to parents, in which case I don't need to move the motion. I will have achieved what I'm seeking to achieve, which is to get the department to understand that what they are producing at the moment is not helpful or meaningful for anybody.
Laurie Hooper there. So Education Minister Daphne Kane.
I guess that whatever he was hoping you might do, you've done in the meantime.
Yes, I think Mr. Hooper required some comfort that the department had listened to the feedback and was aware that for the layperson, the parent or carer, some of the summary reports that are published on each school's website following their independent quality assurance validation visit, perhaps the information contained in those reports was not always easily understood by the intended audience, and we have taken that feedback and given it to the ETIO, the company carrying out our quality assurance validation, and I have undertaken that there will be improvement to the summary report delivering what the feedback has said is required, so that there is a more meaningful, improved format content of summary report provided to parents. And I think I'm also very grateful to my colleagues for attending a session to understand the system of quality validation that we are developing on the Isle of Man is actually something really special, and that while it isn't the high stakes model that you find in neighbouring jurisdictions with the complications, this is something absolutely that gets into the nitty gritty of schools and their performance and areas where they need to improve, i.e. have growth and development, but doing it in a way that the school builds that into their own continuous improvement. And I was very grateful for the feedback and happy that members who've given this subject enormous scrutiny over recent months seem to be satisfied to allow the department to progress with the company and with our schools.
Because on the one hand, I guess the very last thing we want is so much detail being published that schools feel that their only course of action is to effectively teach to the examinations to make sure that they excel in all the areas that they're going to be investigated in. We then end up with children who are exceptionally good at ticking the boxes for the quality assurance review, but maybe not being as well educated as they need. But on the other hand, we do want to have some information that allows us to make meaningful judgments about the success or otherwise of general education policies across the island.
Indeed. I think that what came out today from City and Tynwald is that education, the system, the delivery, the monitoring, the quality assurance of it is very important. But at the end of this, the important thing are those outcomes for individual students, for all learners. And the purpose, and I hope I have conveyed it both in to the members' briefing in leading to this motion, being required in answer to the many questions we've had on it, and also in response to Mr. Morehouse's motion in terms of the department is listening to the feedback. The process we have, schools are continuously improving. They review themselves annually, and then once every 3 years, on a three-year rolling cycle, they have an independent external assessor come to validate their findings. The summary report containing the areas for growth and development, and hopefully to confirm any areas of excellence. Those summary reports, which we accept need to be better, they go published on the department's website if it's an education service, or on the individual school's website. And in addition, the company provides us an annual overview. And that, as we saw from the first year, picked out five areas of need to improve. And while I can sympathise with Mr. Morehouse wanting a particular focus on two of them, the department has put in place, on the back of all that, an educational leadership team, an ELT, sitting under the senior leadership team within the department. And the ELT is made up of our head teachers and leaders who are having the input to address all those areas, those five priority areas across the island that are of concern, again, to help support and improve all aspects of it. And we know that there are significant areas where we do need to improve, and we are enabling that to happen by engaging with all our professionals to drive that from the bottom up as much as the top down. So the validation is an assessment at that moment in time, but they have highlighted the areas where we need to improve as an island, and we are embracing that as a department.
That was Education Minister Daphne Kay in MHK. So what do you think? Was Mr. Hooper right, or just making mischief in relation to the minimum wage? Is the Ramsay political boat rocking, and does that help the town? And what about the release of more information about how our schools are run? That must be a good thing. Let me know what you think by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com, and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now though, I'm Phil Gorn. Gurumayu, thanks for listening.